Sunday, I was talking about the true form of, of reality. I want to continue that today. And it's actually, I've talked about it a couple of times, and it's actually very, I guess, hard to articulate some of these things because they're challenging me in areas that I didn't expect. And it's not, you know, we've all said it, or are you experiencing a salvation that does not have you as its center, as its object of measurement and definition? And we say that, and I've said it many, many times, but yet I didn't realize how deep that statement actually goes. I want to talk about being transformed. Transformation. And we know that many people quote this verse and talk about transformation, and it's chapter 12 of Romans, verses 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And it actually should be the renewing of your mind, proving the will of God acceptable, good, and perfect. This is actually saying the same thing as he says earlier in Romans when he speaks of being, when you were servants of sin, you were free from righteousness. And when you were servants of righteousness, you were free from sin. And that those verses have stuck out to me more particularly recently because of just seeing how absolutely impossible it is. He lays forth an impossibility in those statements. When you were subject to sin, when you were servants of sin, and that's not talking about doing things, that's speaking concerning Romans 7 of who he was trying to apply a holy law to a man that has none of that in himself. As long as you're subject to that law of death and sin that's within you, you are free from righteousness. That's a weird way of saying it, but that's a beautiful way of stating it, because what it shows is the impossibility of conformity. There's a transforming, not a conforming, that's necessary. So when he talks about be not conformed to this world, first of all, you have to see the context of it to understand what he's referring to, because I know people take this and say, do not be conformed to the debaucheries of this present time, 2016. Well, that's commendable. Good. Don't do that. But this is not what Paul's talking about. Paul is speaking about an age that would have you conform. And the word, see, and when we talk about, I'm getting to my point, I'm just babbling right now, but when we talk about transformation and being transformed, we are talking most of the time about conformity. We're talking about conforming outward actions, conforming to a better method and a better mode of conduct or whatever. That is not what he has in mind here. He's talking about a true transforming, an inward transformation, where there is one reality that begins to govern you where this reality once did, or this one thing once did. When you keep it in the context of it, and we'll look at other verses where he's saying the same thing, basically, and just using different phrases, if you take it here into the context, even just go back one chapter to chapter 11, and he begins to talk about the Jews who rejected and refused, and then the Gentiles were grafted in because of their unbelief. And he speaks of the whole situation where do not boast because this has happened. And you read chapter 11, you'll see. And then he sets it up here in these verses, is referring back to this unbelief of the Jews that has caused Gentiles to be grafted in to this olive tree. So he's saying to them now to conform yourself to the standards, practices, religious rites, ceremonies of that administration, of that age, is ridiculous. What profit can there possibly be when you have received in perfect fullness what they were intended to receive? Go back to Romans 9 and 10. What they were intended for, yet refused. And you, having received it in fullness, to go back and conform yourself to that again is insane. But why is that an even a possibility? Because the human heart is inclined toward a familiar thing. It's inclined toward something that makes sense, is digestible to the natural senses. And you say, well, that seems good. It's applicable to me, and I can present some form good to people. They'll see something in me that demonstrates some type of spiritual life, and it may draw them to Jesus. That is just, see, Jesus didn't even draw people to Jesus, when if you want to look at that. So the whole point of being transformed is something totally different than an outward conformity to rites and ceremonies. Where people say, boy, that his life was really transformed. How do you know? Well, he doesn't go to the bars anymore. He goes to church. Really? Is that it? There's something deeper. And this is what I'm being challenged by. How we talk about this which is above, and we talk about this which is spirit. Because, you know, and many people, I know through the years, when they hear me talk, they'd say, well, you're just spiritualizing this. You're spiritualizing. I remember when I first met Brother Lumen, a preacher came to me and warned me about him. And he said, he's very mystical. If there's anyone not mystical, it's J.W. Lumen. There's a lot of reality there. But, oh, he's real mystical. And what I understand now him to mean was he takes everything that we love to involve ourselves in out of us and says, you can't be that. That's what he does. That's what the gospel does. That's why it's the good news. It's not good news when you're still responsible for it. You're still responsible for the demonstrating and the expression and the living it. I remember someone very close to me says, man, this is Christian life. It's really hard to live. I said, yeah, it is when you're trying to be the one living it. It's a difficult thing because you were never intended to be the one living it. The law was not until you could live it. It was until he came as the life of which it spoke. And that life now being present, we still tend to orient our hearts toward conforming to standard rights. And there's nothing wrong with conforming to, you know, laws as far as don't speed, you know, don't break laws, don't act stupid. That's all good. But let's not call that spiritual life. And that's what we've done. We've confused it. You know, he doesn't do these things anymore. He must be real spiritual. No, he just doesn't do those things anymore. I know atheists that do not do the things that Christians still fight. They don't need a spiritual remedy for that. I know people get mad at me when I say things like this, but it's true. Okay. That's fine. But let's not call the not doing of those things a spiritual breakthrough or transformation. When he's talking about transformation, he's speaking of something greater than not doing acts or doing better acts. And I always seem to have to qualify these statements and say, I'm not giving people a license. Well, I'm almost done qualifying statements. The fact is, we just need to see Christ. And if we see Christ, I believe we'll see a reality that is so far beyond us and other than us. We will know how foolish we have been to try to take what is spirit, what is truth, what is reality, and dumb it down and bring it into the earth and still say, well, it's not us, but yet somehow, some way, it always ends up with our resemblance. Or something that we do or do not do that gives some outward evidence of it. We always do that. There is a liberty that comes in the seeing of Christ that does not leave you being and doing whatever you want. It leaves you beholding the reality of a perfect salvation without reference to sin, without reference to you. And this is what's challenging me. Is that the salvation you're knowing? Or you just talk about it? And yet, you still look for something to give proof and evidence. This says, if there is a transformation and a renewing of the mind, which is where it takes place, then there is a proving of the will of God that it is acceptable, perfect, and good. The word proving there actually does. It means to learn or experience the genuineness of it. That's when the proof comes, when there's a transformation. What does that mean? Well, again, we have equated it to conformation, where you try to form your actions to abide by certain standards. That's what I'm talking about. The law didn't speak of that. The law spoke of a transformation to bring us unto Christ. That's another form that the law testified of, but the law was a different form because the law, that form, could not give the life it spoke of. What we're talking about is the form that is spirit and is the life. And I go back to where they'll say, you just spiritualize these things. You're mystical. No, you can't spiritualize what's spirit. When it is spirit, it is spirit. What you mean by that is I can't grab that and run with it and apply it to flesh. No, you can't. Not successfully. Sooner or later, you'll hit that wall of frustration. Hopefully. So what are we talking about when we're talking about transformation? Of course, we just read the be not conformed, but be transformed. What is transformed? If you look at it, the renewing of your mind, being transformed. If you look in the context of the Roman letter and all through his writings, you'll see what he's talking about, because it's the same contrast he's always making. You know, I've heard people talk about transformation to so much, you know, I've read a book one time that had a Superman on the front cover. I'm serious. And it was Adam, Superman Adam, before the fall. Yeah, Daniel knows. He's looking for that day. He has his cape already ready. I've seen it. But Superman Adam, before he could fly, he had a cape. I don't see reference to that, but this book said so. And yet, that's what we're going back to. That's what people think about. You know, it's from just doing better things to flying. That's how broad a spectrum of ignorance this thing goes to. when what Paul's talking about is from the form that testified to the form that is the substance. That's what he's talking about. Transformed is to be transitioned or translated from one form to another form. Not you being transformed like, oh, I'm going to demonstrate them greater form. No, that your soul experiences the greater form of reality and is thereby sanctified from the lesser. Severed in understanding from that. Where you do not lean to that any longer and look to that any longer to give you evidence that you have lacked because of a lack of faith. The whole thing is a lack of faith. The Hebrew letter will tell you, you'll go back to the forms and the rituals when there is no faith. You will miss his rest because of disbelief, unbelief, no faith. Yet that rest is there and given to the soul. But why will you miss it? Because you're in love with the form. Because the form made you secure. Jimmy and I were talking about it. It's a security blanket. It is. Now, we don't have the forms of the tabernacle and all the temple and all of this stuff. But we have our own. We do have good ones that we like. You know, when he talks in, let me go back to Romans 2, because he says the same thing here, and I'll make a point, I promise you. He's speaking to Jews here in Romans 2, and we know what he does in Romans 3. He just eviscerates any hope of righteousness because you're a Jew in the flesh. He says they're all the same, Jew or Gentile, it doesn't matter. Boasting is shut out behind the door. All of that. But here in chapter 2, behold, this is verse 17. Behold, thou art called a Jew, and you rest in the law, making thy boast of God. This is the same boast he said is no longer permitted here in Christ. And knowest his will. That this is what you assume as a Jew. You're assuming this because you have the law. And you approve the things that are more excellent. That's the same word as that you may prove the will of God, good, hope, perfect, and acceptable. Same word here. He's saying because you have the law, you believe that you are proving what is good, acceptable, and perfect, the more excellent things. Do you see how deluded they had become and how deluded we are today? Because you have this form. Here he keeps saying that you approve the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law. The word instructed there is where we get the word catechize or catechism. It's indoctrinate or to give a doctrine to sound down into the ear is what it means. So because you've heard it sounded down in your ear, you believe you know what is more excellent. But what has been sounded down in your ear is nothing more than a testimony to get your heart to turn to see what is more excellent. But because you love the words and you love what the words can mean for you and what they can set forth in your Christian experience, you hold to that and you deceive yourself. Because you've went here, saw yourself, had a preacher confirm it is about you, and you've went your way. And you haven't stayed here and continued in this word until the more excellent man appears. The same thing Jesus says in John chapter 8. If he'll continue in my word, then he shall know the truth. You don't know the truth because you read the word, believed the word, and applied it to you. That's bondage. That's not the liberty promised. The reality of this is we love our form. So he goes on to say, you are confident. Man, look at this. This is a man. Paul knows that these Jews are in the same boat as he was as a Jew. Read chapter 7. This sound like a man confident? No. But these people put on this air of confidence, and they believe they have this. They're confident. You are a guide to the blind, a light of them which are in darkness, instructor of the fools, what it says, a teacher of babes, which has the form of knowledge of the truth in the law. It actually has the form of the knowledge and the truth in the law. A form. You are confident because you have a form that you love and that you appropriate and that you are obedient to, and yet you've missed the whole thing. I remember I was doing this. I did this diagram with Moses up in the mountain, and then, you know, the where they could not see him, and here's Israel waiting. He's up getting the law. And it's, you can read all of this in Exodus 32. And the people cannot see Moses. They do not know what's become of him. He's dead. They don't know. He's been up there a long time. So they go to Aaron and they say, Aaron, make us a god. And they're willing to contribute whatever, but make us a god so that we can worship him and say, this is the God that brought us out of Egypt. Why? Because the man that they saw, that they could see with their natural eye, that was the proof of their deliverance, was no longer visible in that way. See, it's Paul saying, we cannot know him that way any longer. What's he saying? Don't try. It's not going to work. You're trying to know him in a form and in a way you once knew him is not going to work. Because another greater, more perfect, surpassing form has come. The law was given by Moses. Grace and truth came, superseding that. So they're waiting, but then they're impatient. They did not know what had become of him. Make us a god. Okay. God says they corrupted themselves. Moses goes down. Aaron says, well, they come to me, I threw it in, and I threw the gold in the fire, and this cow came out of the fire. But they formed it. They engraved it, they formed it, they made it. And one of the things that I began to see is that because the image that they made, the idol that they made, that they called God, was a familiar idol, because it was an idol that was worshipped in Egypt. So, you see that when this man is not seen, when this man has not yet been revealed, when we will not wait on the appearing of him, we will lovingly, we will desire to fall, we will worship an image, an idol that we worshiped in our own bondage. We would rather do that. Why? Because it's familiar. And it gives us some proof. I've talked about it. The hiddenness of our salvation, the very nature of it, that it is hidden, cannot be known by a natural mind, seen with a natural eye, demands God reveal his Son. That's the demand of this perfect salvation. God doesn't demand anything from you. The demand is for him to do something in you that you can't do. That's the demand. That's why most of the time the active words that religion grabs hold of and says, get about it, are most of the time in the Greek in the passive tense, because they knew you couldn't actively do this on your own. It has to be done by the power of another in you, not by you. But I'm getting off point. But anyway, you have a form of the truth. A form of the knowledge in the law. And you glory in it and boast in it and you love it. And you preach it. And people love it and believe it and they go out and try to apply it. And it's a cycle of condemnation and frustration. And the whole time there is this surpassing greater reality that abides in your soul, that because you're blinded with these familiar idols that we have built, we have missed reality. We've missed it. How, I mean, I've said this a lot of times. How could Paul walk in the midst of all of the things he once gloried in and participated in as a Jew? How can he walk among them now? They're still as impressive as ever. Temple is still as great as ever. So much so the disciples took Jesus to it and said, "Isn't this awesome?" Do you see how crazy that was? And then he departs from it, it says, and like, this is not going to be here any longer. This form's going to go. Your heart better be anchored in something greater than this. So how could Paul do it? Because his heart was anchored in the more excellent thing. At one time he believed he knew what was more excellent. In that form called the law. Now he has seen the excellency of the person of Christ and is able to count that as loss and nothing, not of value, not of gain, because he's seen a greater form, spirit and truth. The moment you take it out of spirit is the moment you have removed all truth from it. And you can take that anywhere you want it. The moment it is out of spirit, I mean spirit, not spiritualizing. Spirit, the person of the Spirit of Christ, the person of Christ. The moment it is outside of Him, divorced from Him, there's no truth in it at all. There's illusions, there's your idols, your imaginations. That's it. And they can look as good as you want to make them. I'm sure that cow sparkled with gold, but it was false. There was a man whose face would shine with the true glory of God that needed to appear. And in his appearing, he would bring the law, the mind, the very thought of God into their midst. But you have to wait on that appearing. You can build your idols anytime. Building your idols doesn't demand any divine help. You can do that on your own. Ishmael can be conceived by your own power. Isaac demands God. So, I mean, even so, even with that, you know, I remember reading with, and this is all the same thing. You go from a form that you're in love with because you created it, just like Abraham with Ishmael. And here's Isaac, the promise, the seed of God. Could not be conjured up by Abraham and his power. And Abraham falls on his face before God and cries out, "Let Ishmael live before you." Why? The form. He loved it. Yet God didn't recognize it. I have cried out to God thinking I was crying out to God. But I was crying out for me. On my face, let Ishmael live. Let this thing that I have created, let this semblance that I'm in love with, let this formation of my own imagination live in your sight. Bend your will toward it and bless it. And you know what? He blessed Ishmael. And you can live in a blessed Ishmael, or you can come to see the true seed. It's a form that, well, let me just say it. Let me go to this verse. I want to read some verses. Luke chapter 17, verse 20, 21. This is from the Young's Literal. Having been questioned by the Pharisees when the reign or kingdom of God doth come, he answered and said, "The reign, kingdom of God, doth not come with observation." Okay, we've talked about that. It does not come with ocular evidence. You can't see it with a natural eye. Well, that's what they were waiting on. Does not come that way. Nor shall they say, "Lo here, lo there." And people think, oh, that's in the future when they start saying, here's the Messiah. Because another place, you know, they'll say, here's Christ, there's Christ. And they'll say, oh, in the future, they're going to do that. And they're going to, it's going to be when the Antichrist is here and they're going to all deceive people. No, that happened now. That happened then. Lo here, lo there. Look at this. That's God. That's Christ. That's the kingdom. That's real. And the moment you can lo there and behold it with a natural eye means it's not. At all. Because look at what he begins to say about the nature of the kingdom that they're wanting to see external. He says, do not go after it. Basically, for the reign of God is within you. Meaning it is inward in nature. And we'll take that and we'll put a big but on the end of that statement. Yeah, but it has to have some. Who says? Who says? We do. You know why? Because we are involved in that part. Why don't we just get our hearts settled upon the knowing of the inward kingdom and stop worrying about the other? That's a thought. Whether it happens or not should not be a concern. And it should not even be a thought in your mind. What should be the only pursuit of your heart, the inclination of your heart toward God is, show me this kingdom that's within. Show me your Son. Reveal Him. Not so that I can or so that there can be. Imaginations and idols. There are future idols, not just past idols. There are present idols as well. But there are future idols. And the whole thing of futurism, there's a root to it all. And that's because we look at ourselves and we look to the world, especially look at it now. Good God, you know? We're ready for this election to get over with. So people look at this and they give, I mean, there are Christian television networks that are doing shows about this election and talking about how we're God's land. Who? What? It doesn't make sense. America doesn't belong to God any more than any other nation. That's not God's people. You have just eradicated the whole thing. I'm not saying don't vote. That's not my point. I'm saying it's all ridiculous. Yeah, they're both crazy. Okay. But that has nothing to do with the kingdom. Has nothing to do with reality. Has nothing to do with my salvation. None of that touches it. See, I fell in love with my righteousness, with what I thought I had. That's what I loved. Did I love God? Probably. But I loved what God did for me and allowed me to do more than that. What I assume, it's a form. We look not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are unseen. You want to call that mystical? Fine. Paul calls it faith. Paul calls it seeing Christ. Paul calls it God revealed His Son in me. And when that anchor was set, it was set forever. And I no longer looked at that past, that form that had passed to find anything. Because I'd found all proof and evidence in the person of Jesus Christ. This is, I know I'm jumping around, but lo here, lo there. This is still going on, lo here, lo here. Where's your soul anchored is the question. What kingdom are you seeing? What righteousness are you observing? Or do you still feel that urge to show it to somebody so they can say, oh, he's doing well. Boy, he sure is got it. He's got his stuff together. telling you, if they point to that and they can say that about you, they have divorced it from the person of Christ. Because they haven't seen him, they've just seen you, and they're assuming upon something they've seen. All of our definitions are ridiculous. I mean, I was brought up under stuff. You couldn't wear a wedding band, you couldn't wear buttons, you couldn't wear a tie. All that was too flamboyant, that wasn't God. See? How ridiculous. And we'll say, oh yeah, that's ridiculous. But and the moment you put a butt on that, you're putting your definition on it. Do you remember? We've talked about it. Ezekiel had to declare the house to the house. Well, guess what house he had to declare to them? The house that had to be revealed to Ezekiel. Could he show that to anybody? The word show doesn't mean demonstrate. It means proclaim. Declare. Proclaim this house to the people that assume they are the house. Declare this righteousness to those who assume they have one. Man, that's not good. That's not an easy thing. No, it's not. It's impossible. Now, it's not impossible to declare it. It's impossible for them to see it, except they see him. That's why in your declaring, and the whole thrust of our declaration is, come and see this man. Remember the woman at the well? She came there. That was a testimony. Here he sits as the substance of that testimony, and she's like, are you greater than this? You greater than our Father who gave us this? Not only that, I am. I am the one you're looking for. And what does she do? After her encounter with him, leaves her pot and goes. Never coming back to that place because she left her utensil with which she had drawn. I'm not coming back to this. I found the water my soul was after, what it was created for. And how does she approach the people in her city? She didn't say, look, I'm a better person after I've encountered him. I'm no longer the person you knew I was. Because she had quite a history. No, she said, come see this guy. Come and see this man. See, that's the thrust of the gospel. Because that's the only time your soul is going to encounter something that exceeds the testimony, that exceeds the previous form that you drew from and received sustenance from. But all the time you're still thirsty and you had to go back. You're still thirsty and you had to go back. There's a point in time when you're seeing Christ. The seeing of Christ means you'll never go back. Because you're satisfied. The soul is satisfied and anchored in spiritual reality. And I don't feel, here's the thing, I no longer feel pressure to prove it to you. I don't. I don't feel pressure to prove it. Because to see the proof of it, you're going to have to see the same one I'm seeing. That doesn't mean I act stupid and all this. No. I mean, you know, having to qualify these things is ridiculous. I'm not saying, you know, do stupid stuff and say, oh, you just need to see Jesus. I'm saying they need to see Jesus just like you do. Because guess what? You can be the best person, the most proper person, and still they need to see Jesus. Just as bad. What I'm saying is there's a moment, there is a point, there's a time where we finally have to say, I need to see something that is not about me. Something that does not center in, focus on, and find its meaning and measure in myself. And guess what? He's already given you that. And it's his desire to reveal him. Righteousness is a person, not a conduct or code or method. We have had it sounded down into our ears. We've been catechized and indoctrinated so much. It's time we see Jesus. And we'll realize that the things that I'm saying right now are not as crazy as they sound. Because there is a greater form. How crazy was it that Jesus tells a Jew, you must be born again? Because unless you're born again, you can't see the kingdom. Wait a minute, I'm a Jew. I'm part of the kingdom of God. What are you talking about? This is the kingdom that comes not with observation. This is a spiritual kingdom. That's why spiritual birth is necessary. The Jews thought if you're born naturally a Jew, you were already in the kingdom. You were the kingdom of God. Now, there was a greater manifestation of the kingdom, but you were going to be that kingdom manifest. He's going to show you who you really are, or show who you really are to the world. People still wait on that. But how crazy was it to this man to hear, no, 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 being born a Jew means nothing. Not when it pertains to the kingdom, not when it pertains to anything spiritual, means nothing. That's what he says, what we were reading a while ago in Romans 2 and Romans 3. And it means nothing. You a Jew means nothing. You must be born again. Another must live. Another life must come and find residence in your soul and be made unto your soul. Everything that this form pointed to but could not provide. There's a reality that we're missing because we love our forms and we love the even if it was a true form. And that was the whole point of Hebrews. There was a true form that God gave as a testimony, but there is the greater reality that has come in the person. Now, do not go to this having come to this one. Do not look to this again because you've come to something better. And that's all I'm saying. The hope in my heart is that I would see him better and more perfectly. That I would know and be anchored in a reality that would, although objectively sanctified from all else, my soul would experientially be severed from those things, because I am recognizing something better, something greater, something that has apprehended my soul first, so that I may apprehend him. Now, the whole thing here was when Paul says this in Galatians, and we, again, we make so much out of this and I think miss the whole point of it. Because you have to, again, look at the context of the letter. Oh yeah, well, this is one of them. this is one of the verses. Look at what he says. Howbeit then, when you knew not God, you did service unto them which by nature are no gods. That's an idol. Remember, we were talking about Moses and them making the idol when they could not see Moses. One of the commentaries I read referred back to this too. When he says this, what he's doing is equating ignorance of God, not ignorance that there is one, but ignorance of God. And he's equating that with the worship of idols. And the crazy thing that Paul is addressing here is he's saying that, okay, you worship these idols when you were a Gentile, but to go back to these empty forms of the Jewish religion is just as bad as worshiping of those idols. It's all the same because it stems from the same thing, and that is ignorance from God, of God, a not knowing. We love them. So we desire, as he says, to be in bondage to them because we believe they will end up giving us something promised. Remember Peter says they promise you liberty, but they themselves are the servants of corruption. You're not going to receive liberty in these forms. These are idols. But Paul says it this way. Paul says to them, I travail in birth till Christ be formed in you. Now, what does that mean? Because this is the necessary thing. This is what's necessary. The inward forming of Christ. I travail in birth till Christ be formed in you. Does that mean so you can all be holy and righteous? No, he's totally shown you that's impossible in that letter. So you can finally live what the law says, he's shown that's an impossibility. I mean, the whole fruit of the Spirit and the works of the flesh is him contrasting Ishmael and Isaac, you and Christ, me and Christ. And showing they'll never be the same, not even similar. There's a total contradiction there. Enmity, the spirit and the flesh. They cannot work together to bring about some good result. Impossible. So what does it mean that Christ be formed in you? Now you can take this and believe it or not, I don't care. I just think this is what he's talking about. He's not talking about some outward conformity, some great demonstrative effect. He's talking about that the form of spiritual reality would so capture your soul that Christ himself, as he truly is, would be the governing reality and the governing realization and acknowledgement in your heart that you no longer are susceptible to these outward forms. You're no longer susceptible to the pull of fleshly pursuit. But your soul is anchored that Christ, as he truly is, the excellency of him, the surpassing nature and better thing, the good thing that is within you, would so govern your soul. Lack of a better term, I can't think of a better one. That these things will no longer be necessary for you. These things are no longer valid. Why do you need circumcision in the flesh when you have seen the greater and are experiencing the greater circumcision of the heart? Why do you need a festival and a feast day and all of those things when you are partaking of him, eating his flesh, drinking his blood, truly knowing communion with the Lord? This is, again, hard to articulate, hard to say, and it's hard sayings. I know. I'm not just throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I'm just saying. I'm not saying got to get rid of these bad things. And no, I'm saying we need to see Christ. Because I think when we see Christ, we'll see an altogether perfect reality. Because we'll see what is spirit and truth instead of what is good and evil. Because that's our compass, good and evil. So we just call good and evil spiritual and not spiritual. But it's the same thing, because it comes out of our imagination and our assumptions. Spiritual life is spirit. Andrew Murray says that the real problem with Christians is they are totally ignorant of the nature of salvation, and that is, it is spirit. So they think humanly upon divine matters and miss the whole point. That's right. We have brought everything that is spiritual, everything that pointed to him, and we've brought it, we have totally brought it back down to ourselves in some way, shape, or form. Will the seeing of him affect? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's not up to me to determine that effect. Or to determine how it will look. Or to preach that as a doctrine. Come and see. Come and see the real thing. Don't take my word for it. Don't take what you see of me and say, oh, I want to be like that or emulate that. Absolutely not. I know good and well you won't do that looking at me. Looking at Judith. Look at Judith. Don't look at Judith either. I know you can do that. But here's the point. The whole thing, the transforming, the renewing of the mind, it's about seeing reality for it. And this is the whole thought of the discernment that he talks about in Hebrews. Why do you think he's talking about the exercising of the senses and discernment in the letter to the Hebrews? Because it is that discernment from that very impressive form of the law in the first age to that which is absolutely without form. That has no external evidence in that way. You see, it can almost be anticlimactic when you don't understand how much greater this is. When you haven't seen this as it truly is, when you haven't seen his face, you will think to say, he's all of it. He's everything. He's the perfection of all that. It sounds kind of weak. Wait a minute, what? I mean, that thing was made out of marble and gold. Look at it. Yeah, but he's it. He's the substance. He is the true house of God. He is erected of God in resurrection. He, in 3 days, the true temple was raised. It's him. That just sounds real weak to people when they haven't seen him. So instead of just waiting to see him, we're saying, well, there's going to be an impressive one day. And we contribute money to help build it or whatever we do. See what I'm saying? Whole root of all of this. The whole root of futurism. The whole root of futurism as it pertains to my receiving or achieving spiritual attributes. Getting righteous, being holy, all of those things. It's still a futurism, just a different form of it. If he has made unto you righteousness, what is there to achieve? He either is or he isn't. Paul lied or he didn't. It's not about achieving, it's about acknowledging, recognizing, the revealing of that reality in your soul to see him as what you've tried to achieve and attain without any success. Or you've tried, or you thought you achieved it, and you're in love with your assumption. But the whole root of it is we look at ourselves, look at the world, and we say, no, this can't be it. No, that's not it. Oh, this can't be all. This can't be it. Jesus can't be done. Yes, he is. You're just looking in the wrong place to find the right thing. You're looking at you to find what he is. You're looking at the world to find what's in a new creation. That's what I'm saying. God must intervene in this, or we're just going to be swamped down with our idols. He must reveal the truth. We must see reality in its true form. The person of spirit and truth. Or else, we're blind. And we know not. We know not what's become of this man, as they said of Moses. Make us a God. Tell us about this God. Make us a God we can see. Give us a righteousness we can observe and participate in and manifest. It's all the same thing. May our hearts see Him. May our hearts be pursuing nothing more than to know Him. I mean, look at Paul. Paul has just said, I have counted my former things, my former righteousness, my former life, my boast, the whole thing in which I boast that I counted as loss because I've seen something greater. And what is the climax of that? To know Him. That's it. That's all there is. Grow in the grace and the knowledge of the Lord. And all these things, we won't fight over it. We'll see something more perfect than we've ever imagined. Because He appears as that perfection without reference to the thing I thought demonstrated it. Perfect. Spirit truth. All right, I'm done. Thank you.